accession number 23818, Reel 7.
Commander Easton, Reel 7. We're talking about the anti-submarine contacts, the ASDIC, and the events of the convoy in November, distant escort of SL-139 in the Bay of Biscay in November 1943. Anything else you remember about the sort of anti-submarine operations that took place at that time?
I don't believe we were on this particular operation for very long. I can't recall anything, unless it was that might have been the occasion when we were detached to the Azores.
Halfway through, yes.
Yeah, yes, to refuel and to rearm with depth charges. We had a pretty heavy consumption of depth charges. So we went back. I think there was some defect involved in some ship, which required examination, some vibration. We went back to the Azores, did all we had to do, able to get some good fruit on board, of course, from visiting boats from shore, particularly pineapples. Weren't able to get ashore, and sailed again.
When you sail again, there's a second part of this Bay offensive, was a sort of screening convoy SL-140, which is another one, which you also might not have met, you know. And there were, again, it says continuous Wolfpack attacks, which were beaten off without casualties. I mean, do you remember anything in particular of that? Or
I think during this time as well, there was the incident with a surface U-boat at night.
What do you remember of that?
Very calm sea. In fact, not a breath of wind. Proceeding along a course in company with some other ships of the group at night. Detected a radar echo some miles ahead, turned towards it and slowed down, the tactical move to avoid being heard by the submarine too far further away than you need. Really, rather like a cat creeping up to a mouse. When quite close, that's to say, probably about 2 miles, the echo disappeared. Obviously, had seen us or heard us most likely, and submerged. Had to be very careful then, because the greatest, most dangerous weapon the U-boat carried was the acoustic torpedo, which would home onto the sound of a ship's propellers, and that sank many a ship. So there was a procedure laid down called the step-aside procedure, which was designed to cope with this situation. You run in towards the U-boat at a certain distance, you alter course a lot to one side, about 70 degrees to one side, by that time he would have probably fired his torpedo, which would go on to where you were. Then you turn back towards him again. We did that. I think we got ASDIC contact all right, but it didn't result in a confirmed kill for us. But that was one submarine that wouldn't have recharged his batteries, therefore probably never caught up with the convoy.
Well, what was it like when you dropped the depth charges? I mean, you know.
Well,
you dropped him on this occasion, I presume, wasn't it?
Yeah, oh yes. Something you get completely used to. The effect is varying. The most drastic effect is if you set the depth charges to explode very shallow. You can alter the settings on them to explode anywhere from 20 feet out to 1,000. But it was never enough to damage the ship. If the depth charge was set really deep, it would take quite a long time to reach the depth it had to explode at, and the percussion was much less.
What was your sort of overall daily routine during this period? You know, because it was fairly continuous action. What was your routine?
Up at crack of dawn to record the morning stars, star sight, as I've explained in the previous.
Same procedure.
Work out your position. Then either just carry on with one's routine work, which I mentioned before, of putting information on charts, including one aspect I hadn't mentioned before, which was the whole mining scene. One was kept informed of minefields, whether they be knowledge of enemy minefields or ones we laid ourselves mostly by signals, and of course they had to go onto your chart straight away, because every port, every narrow, every channel was controlled by minefields with narrow channels, so they just had to be right. So there's usually something to be done in that respect. So the day went by with routine work.
Would you largely be on the bridge or in the chart house?
Yeah, nearly all the time.
So your cruising station was in effect your action station and vice versa? You know.
On the bridge, yes, absolutely, yes.
Was it almost like a 9-to-5 job in the sense that you had, well, earlier than 9, from dawn to dusk? Would you actually work that sort of a day and then go to sleep at night? Or assuming there was no action. Because you didn't follow the watches, did you?
Well, quite often not. Depended to some extent how many officers we had at the time. But I would almost certainly have at least one watch in the course of the day to do, 1 4-hour watch, and possibly more. But I'd be up, as I say, at dawn. I'd be up at any little incident that happened in the course of the night. I might have to alter course at some stage, or some planned alteration of course, to see that was done on time. All the things you could imagine if one's actually in charge of the navigation of the ship.
So like the skipper, you'd be called out at any time if there was a navigational question or an action.
Oh, yes.
Well, what did watch keeping entail? Could you just run through that for me again?
As officer of the watch, you were, by regulation, in charge of the ship. You are like acting captain. You have to keep a good lookout, see a good lookout is kept, be listening and acting on the communications from the other ships, alterations of course all ordered by the leader, do the current navigation, taking bearings of lights and if they didn't require me, if it might be quite routine passage. Of course, there weren't very many shore lights on in those being wartime. Everything which concerned the conduct of the ship. If you suddenly made an Aztec contact, you had to initiate necessary actions by the ship until the captain appeared, who he would probably take over.
So you'd be doing your basic duties as navigation officer. You'd be on call. You'd occasionally be acting as officer of watch. Would that be sort of be basically?
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, what about your cabin? We haven't discussed this actually. what sort of accommodation did you have aboard the Coleman?
Pretty good. Single or double berth cabins.
Which were you in?
I had a single berth cabin. It's just let off. First of all, I had a double cabin, and then I was able to go into a rather better single cabin.
Now, what were these cabins like? Could you just describe what they looked like, how big they were, and what sort of things they had in?
Size, about, say, 10 feet by 6. In it, a bunk, or two bunks.
Were they the same size, the single and the doubles, or would the doubles be slightly bigger?
Usually the doubles would be a bit bigger, yes.
So they had a bunk. How did you take to the bunk?
Oh, very nice. they're perfectly good. They had kind of mesh spring mattresses, very comfortable. I think there would have been a desk there, a little chest of drawers, probably a cupboard, a cupboard for hang up clothes. Very likely a small wash basin. That would be about it. Ventilation, of course, all the time, blowing through louvers, so little round things which could change the direction, rather like a big version of a bus or an airliner, in that respect.
And what about your food on board the Calder? Where would you get it? How is it served up? What would you get as an officer?
Pretty good. There was a wardroom, cook, who, although he must have cooperated a lot with the ship's company cooks in the same galley, they worked generally to different menus, so they could combine if they want to. I think that was a matter of their own common sense. Stewards who would have been a leading steward in the pantry and two officer stewards. One table, of course, but with a necessary number of chairs, 6 to 8 chairs. A hatch through to the pantry. The actual content of the meals are very good. I mean, as far as possible, a three-course meal, but it couldn't always be managed. If the weather was hideous, you might well be down to corned beef sandwiches all round. But in general, it was very good.
And what about the wardroom? Could you describe what the wardroom was, what it provided for you as officers?
Well, the dining table, probably some sofa-type seating. necessary movable chairs. In front of the hatch to the pantry would be an area where you could, where dishes, of course, could be put, as one could expect. One or two pictures on the bulkheads, according to one's own taste. Not a lot more. Simple, functional. Just thinking, where the drinks were stowed.
I was going to ask about drinking habits anyway. Was it a drinking mess, a hard drinking mess? Or a...
Yes, but like any other ship, drinking at sea, practically zero. We certainly weren't a hard drinking lot, no.
Was that sort of the ethos of the ship, or was that a set of individual decisions?
I think that ships generally conform to the same pattern. No one would have drinked a lot at sea. It just didn't. But it just didn't seem to figure. Perhaps one drink. I doubt ever more.
And what about in harbour? Pollock dock.
Well, there would usually only be a very small number of officers on board. Because when you were in, then was probably half of them were on leave. Leaving just half back in the ship at any one particular time. But there things are a bit more easygoing, and you could have the odd party with other, usually involving officers from other ships, or but might quite possibly be friends from ashore.
What would the parties be like? I mean... For instance, there's a tale in Huckle's things of messing about when you first got in, messing about with the practice wooden gun, 3-inch gun that they had for. Do you remember any of that?
I don't remember that. The scope for a sort of for a that kind of party, it all depends upon the, to some extent, on the size of the ship. If you have a bigger ship with a bigger wardrobe, then you can have all sorts of fun and games. With best parties. For talking about the Calder, the ship was usually either at sea or in harbour with half of them back home on leave.
What was your drink of what would you normally drink when you had a drink?
Of course, there was no canned beer in those days. I suppose the two main hard drinks were gin and tonic, or gin and lime, or brandy and ginger. Brandy and ginger were always called a horse's neck. They were the two main ones. Not very much whiskey was drunk, funnily enough. I don't know why. Very little rum in the wardroom. So, most likely a gin and lime, bearing in mind at duty-free prices in those days, a little bottle of mineral water would cost more than the gin itself. The bottle of gin was only about three shillings, which would do umpteen drinks. So the mineral would cost more than the spirit. So one tended not to drink much of those.
Did you have a responsibility as a divisional officer to, you know, to a section of the crew?
Yes.
Can you tell us what it was and how you got on with those men you were divisional officer to?
Because I had all the communication ratings, because communications, it was radio, WT, wireless telegraphy, visual signalling with Morse lights and flags. There will be a petty officer called the Yeoman of Signals, and three signalmen, junior ratings, and a petty officer telegraphist, and probably about four telegraphists, two coders who were constantly deciphering and coding, and they were at sea, always working in watches. So I normally saw the backs of their heads as they're at their desk with their headphones on. They were just down below the chart house, just down the bottom of the ladder. So I was in and out of that place all the time, having a look at latest signals that are coming in and all that, you know, general minute-to-minute things.
So they were your men.
Yes.
What was the job of divisional officer?
In a word, their welfare, which embraced their ordinary living conditions, through to qualifications and promotion and instruction, courses perhaps, what so we say career matters.
Did you have to take up with their personal problems?
Well,
if they had them.
Yes, one should do. Not easy for a young man of 19 to look after personal problems of young men, same age or some of them older. But yes, one certainly had taken interest in their personal problems. Of course, one had to censor their mail. That's all another chore one had to do every day, a big pack of letters where officers had to sit down and just quickly whiz through all the mail, their letters.
What were you looking for?
Information regarding the ship's movements. That's what really, when one just skimmed one's eye through them and sealed them up.
Do you find that embarrassing?
No, it did happen every day. Nobody minded. No, it's as long as it wasn't of use to the enemy.
Now, the next, after this sort of period in November, during the Bay Offensive, mm-hmm. you know, that you then were put on what were known as a KMF tour.
Oh, yes.
To the troop ships going to, yes. To the Mediterranean.
Yes.
Now, that was, what do you remember of those KMF convoys? Because you were doing that from, I think, December 1943 through to October, October 1944. A long time, you know, in a routine. What do you remember of the KMF convoys?
I think that they sailed at least mainly from Liverpool. They were liners. Of all the big names you could think of the Union Castle Line and Red Funnel, splendid ships. Being liners, they were comparatively fast. Normally proceeded at a speed of advance of 16 knots, zigzagging all the time. they're practically, I don't think they were ever successfully attacked by submarines, because you, at that speed, it's to a submarine, it's rather like swatting a passing fly, when you're practically stopped, when you're submerged. And they were all very well escorted, had a complete screen of frigates and all destroyers around them. So we would be part of the screen of a KMF convoy, and proceeding at quite 16, 18 knots, zigzagging with them. And it was regarded as a very soft number, because you were quickly through the dirty weather into the Mediterranean, heading for Naples.
Mm. So this was just a routine sailing?
Well, we did lots of them. We did, I don't know how many we did, 10 or a dozen.
Seems to have been almost sort of one a month.
Yes. There were troop convoys, mostly for the Italy and Africa.
Now, were there any actual incidents you remember during this period? Or was it really one of just basic routine?
As far as the escorting the convoy side of it, it was really routine. Each trip must have taken about 5 to 7 days, something like that. We never went as far east as Malta, so we never really got in range of any of the really serious fighting the Eastern Med. We visited Naples several times.
What was it like? Did you get ashore?
Yes, remember seeing Rigoletto in the National Theatre there. I remember it quite clearly. Nothing very remarkable.
How did you get on with the Italians?
Perfectly well. I don't recall any incidents at all. Weather can be nasty, actually. We had several pretty hectic days off Naples, blowing really hard. So it wasn't all just Italian sunshine and calm seas. In the winter, the Mediterranean is very, gets quite nasty.
And what about were you aware of the sort of black market activities of some of the crew in Naples? Because it was a bit of a temptation to some of them.
Oh yes, I don't recall myself being involved in it, but I'm sure Harold Fine was. He'd be the first to admit it. It was rather more later on, as you may hear, when we visited Germany at the end of the war.